It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. All of this could have been avoided if we'd followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop the hammering. Stop the hammering out there. Who's got a hammer?
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Be sure and keep that volume up.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. It is Honestly Provocative Talk Radio for the Pacific Northwest, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho over the great Radio Northwest Network. Nothing like it anywhere else in the United States of America. I'm glad to be with you. We have a lot of things to consider today, and I might just surprise a few of you by telling you that I agree with Jay Inslee. Jay Inslee is the estimable governor of Washington State. I don't think much of most of what he has to say, but I have to grudgingly agree with him on this. There's been a lot of talk about bump stocks in the last 36 hours or so. Bump stocks, it turns out, are the devices that are used to make an AR-15, the perfectly legal, most popular sporting rifle in America, to make it mimic the actions of a fully automatic weapon. It does not become a fully automatic weapon, and it takes a little more than radio to explain how a bump stock works, but if you know what a semi-automatic rifle is, every time you pull the trigger, a bullet is fired. And that's what happens. You can empty a semi-automatic 30-round magazine very quickly. A bump stock allows it to mimic an automatic weapon. That is what Stephen Paddock used on Sunday night to murder 59 people and send more than 500 people to the hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada. So, should we make bump stocks that turn semi-automatics into apparently fully automatics illegal? I'm not going to get into the, you know, if you want to define what doesn't turn it into an automatic, I understand that. But just for the sake of the question, we made it simple. Should we make them illegal? I actually don't have a problem with that. I actually have a couple of them, not because I bought them, but because companies said, here, try this out. And I took it home and put it on a shelf in my shop, and I've not looked at them again. Because I just don't have any interest in trying to modify the AR-15s I own to do what these do. I'm sure for some people, they're a ball of fun. In one case, in the last 42 years that I've been doing radio news, in one case, I have heard of somebody committing crimes with a bump stock. And that was Sunday night of this week in Las Vegas. Other than that, I have never heard of one being used in a crime. And I only say that in aid of this objection. If you want to go after the problem of people who commit the crime of murder using a firearm, what the left likes to call gun violence or gun whatever, they want to turn gun into everything. Well, you want to go after that? Go after pistols in the hands of criminals. And I can give you a couple of examples of how to do that. But the left doesn't want to do that. They want to pass more laws. And I think it's for the most narcissistic, egotistical reasons that they want to pass new laws, because they can say there was a horrible crime that happened in Las Vegas and we got a new law passed. Now, if you count them all up, the number of laws, I got this question a few times in the last 24 hours, the number of laws already on the books in the United States of America at the federal level, at the state level, at the county level, at the city level, and probably even political jurisdictions below that. It's about 20,000. 20,000 laws. But there are people out there. I understand they're Democrats. We have to spot them a couple of points because their IQs may not be as high. Who say if we have 20,000 laws, if we can just pass one more, we will stop terrible things from happening. Now, I think they're deluded in believing that. I don't think there's any rational reason that they can give that 20,000 laws will not stop lawbreakers. But one more, if they write it just the right way, will. But I can and I will not, you know, be like a stick in the mud and say I'm not going to do something like what Jay Inslee has proposed. Let's make those devices illegal to manufacture. Now, I'll tell you as a warning, they're not hard to make on your own. There are homemade versions, and it's going to be very difficult to ban those. I guess you could say we're going to go out and prosecute anybody that we've found who's ever gone out and figured some other way to make a semi-automatic rifle fire faster. But you could, I guess, throw a few people in prison. I would suggest you throw people in prison for doing straw man purchases and stealing guns and putting guns in the hands of criminals. That is a far bigger concern than somebody who owns AR-15s and gets a charge out of going to a range somewhere and having his gun fire in a way that mimics a fully automatic weapon. But if that's what you want to do, do it. I'm just telling you, it is not going to change violence much, if at all, in the United States of America. So that's on the agenda. Should Northwest states finally comply with the U.S. Real ID Act, Washington State will not. Oregon has grudgingly said, well, we'll kind of get about it. Maybe it'll be done in 3 years. Do you realize that the deadline for compliance with the Real ID Act has been extended and extended by Northwest states? The last extension, well, the last deadline was October 10th, 6 days from now. The federal government has now said we will extend it one more time to January 22. And after that, without another extension, you will not be able to use a Washington or Oregon driver's license to get on an airplane because you won't have the ID that'll get you past the TSA. And that isn't going to catch people who have to fly all the time like me because I have to fly all the time for work. But it will catch the person who's called on short notice and told, can you fly or can you go somewhere for a wedding or a funeral or some kind of family emergency? They're going to show up at TSA and TSA is going to say, hey, that Oregon, Washington driver's license, that ain't going to get you on the plane. Go back and start over. We'll talk about that as well. We'll talk with Nigel Jaques, the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from Willamette Week. He comes on every, well, he doesn't come on every week, but somebody does from Willamette Week because we're glad to highlight some of their best stories. This one is extraordinary. It is about an extraordinary waste of public resources when it comes to emergency medical services, and you're going to want to hear about that. We'll talk about the Edmonds woman who at the age of 24 was going to community college and then changed her ambition to that of serial killer, and we'll talk about that. Sebastian Gorka, not long ago, he worked at the White House. He is now out in the private sector. We'll talk to Sebastian Gorka about whether or not the Vegas shooter fit the profile of an ISIS convert, and if not, why would they claim him at this point? We'll talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, which has taken up an issue that affects public unions, but it also affects worker liberty. And is government getting in the way of housing that people can afford? There's a very good case to be made that that is happening as well. And I always invite your phone calls and emails. I try to make this the best conversation in talk journalism. And you can reach it at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense. Presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
As a talk show host, I absolutely love labor unions. They do the craziest things, and that usually makes my daily topic research very, very easy. Thanks, union bosses. Let me offer two examples. In Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court has now taken up the question of whether Americans should be forced to pay union dues. Now, the unions argue, the poor unions, they argue they'll take a hit if they can't force people to join their little workplace extortion clubs. What a ringing endorsement of forced unionism. Meanwhile, in Spokane, a community rocked recently by a deadly school shooting, they would like to have school resource officers actually carry guns. They do not currently in Spokane. A report 5 years ago recommended arming school resource officers, but the labor union that represents those officers says, well, that's a matter of collective bargaining. So get this. Even though they think that the officers should have the guns to protect themselves and the children, the union says they can't even talk about the issue until union negotiations begin 2 years from now. If you're the parent of a student in a school, are you willing to wait for that? And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran-owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
Ah, today's Daily Grill goes to the states of Oregon and Washington for not complying quickly with the Real ID Act and putting their citizens at a real disadvantage very, very soon. From our Facebook page, and that's The Lars Larson Show. Lars, you were talking about unions. I was in a union. I was even a shop steward for a while. Machinists and aerospace workers. I was sent to a very nice training facility in Maryland for a week. Plus, I got to visit the Union Grand Lodge, a granite and glass palace. I was not happy that union dues were paying for all this. I quit shop steward, and I wished I could have gotten out of the union after I saw all this. What a total scam it all is. They make huge amounts of money off the sweat of the working chump. Signed, Eric Scarbury. And our best email today, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, comes from Alan. Lars, it's illogical for me to believe that the Las Vegas shooter would have gone to such great lengths and detail in preparation for his act and not left a written or recorded message explaining the reasons for his actions. I suspect the killings were intended to call attention to his message. The only reason I can imagine to leave it a mystery would be to plant the seed in my and others' minds that information about his reasons was being withheld by our government. However, I don't see him as being a sophisticated thinker. What are your thoughts, please? Signed, Alan. I'll give you my thoughts all afternoon today. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to have you vote in our Twitter poll, which you'll find in a couple of places. One on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show, and the second location, the LarsLarson.com website. Should we make bump stocks that turn semi-automatics into full automatics illegal? I'd say yes. I think it's an easy grab, but I know I'm going to get some naysayers on this, but I want to hear what the argument is, because Stan's on the line, who's a naysayer. Stan, I've wrestled with this ever since yesterday, when a lot of us began to believe that this was probably the way that Stephen Paddock had managed to make a semi-auto, otherwise legal semi-automatic rifle fire that way. And I thought, where am I going to come down on bump stocks? Because up till now, I haven't really cared about it. It's the first time in my entire career as a journalist that I've ever heard about one being used in a crime. But I also thought, well, what's my objection going to be? I frankly don't care if they're legal or not. And I don't see it as part of a slippery slope. But where do you come down on
it? Well, I look at it two ways. I see you got, obviously, it's never been used in a crime before, but also it's not really a firearm. It's not restricting any type of firearm. So that's kind of a back and forth on the Second Amendment issue.
Yeah.
But as a gun owner, I'm tired of compromising and getting nothing in return. I care nothing of bump stocks. If we give up bump stocks, I want something in return. I want some Democrats to sign on to the SHARE Act or nationwide reciprocity or something. It seems like every time something comes along, we always give a little. We always lose a little, one at a time, here and there, whether it's state level or federal level. And whenever the time comes for us to get something as gun owners, we don't get any traction. So
can I try to persuade you that I think we do get something out of it, and something tangible. I mean, I also believe in feeding the favor bank. I do a lot of things where I never expect a return. But you're right. In politics, ordinarily, we're not giving up anything unless you give up something. Here's what I think we gain in it. Up to this point, the liberal Democrats can make the argument, well, you know, the Republicans or the conservatives, the pro-Second Amendment folks, are never willing to give, even when it makes sense to give on something. And I think if we said, we're going to give this one, it's a gimme. Let's go ahead and give you that. All right. And they say, well, what do you want in return? Nothing right now. But what we get is the next time that a Democrat or a liberal stands up and says, you know, these folks are never willing to give on regulation, we can point out two big gives in the last 30 years. One was Ronald Reagan signing the 1986 ban on fully automatic firearms. And that was, it was a sensible ask, and we gave it, and we didn't get much for it. If we give on this one, and where it's inconsequential, I don't know how many people actually have these things. I have a couple of them. They're sitting on a shelf, and I don't ever intend to use them, and I didn't buy them. They were just given to me. And if we give this, the next time somebody says, you guys won't give on anything, we say, yeah, we do. Look at that. Look at bump stock. Look at full automatic firearms signed into law by the best Republican president of the last 100 years. And then you get that. You can at least answer that argument that way. Does that seem like a like an advantage that would be worth it?
Well, I guess it is wouldn't be giving up something insignificant for some sort of a PR victory, but I would still personally like to see something a little bit more, because I know we shelved the SHARE Act, or Ryan said that he wasn't going to bring it to a vote after this. Maybe the one on
suppressors, which I criticized Ryan for that yesterday, because I said, look, this has nothing to do with what happened in Las Vegas, with other than what Hillary Clinton said, that somehow she believed that if a guy had used a suppressor, that people would not have realized what was going on. It shows just how Looney Tunes Hillary Rodham Clinton really is. But it's a stupid argument. But for Ryan to have given up, that was something significant. Because for people who want to go to a gun range and practice and not have the neighbors, upset over the noise, for people who want to be able to shoot without having to put on as much hearing protection as you ordinarily have to wear, it's a reasonable ask. And I would like to see the Democrats give some reasonable back. Let's go to naysayer Greg. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program. Do you have a good argument for why they should not be made illegal?
Hey, Lars. I'm in your boat. I really don't care about them, and I think they eat up your accuracy. But at this point, I put this in the do-nothing legislation policy. This is the same thing as the NFA back when the mob was acquiring Thompson. Oh, we'll make them too expensive to get, except the guy had the money to buy them, and he got around it, and they weren't buying them legally anyway. This whole episode wasn't about a bump stock. It was about an evil guy that decided to do something evil.
Couldn't agree more.
He could have figured out how to make his weapon do the same thing that he intended to do. And I'm tired of watching, saying, well, this is a give me, that to give me. No, that's nothing. That's wasting my time as a taxpayer. I honestly feel like as a taxpayer with Congress, if you kowtow on this one, why am I paying your salary? You're wasting my time with something that does nothing of what you intended for it to do.
The only thing I'd point out to you is if you give it, and you say, okay, we'll give you this gimme. It isn't going to change anything. And we can use the opportunity to point out it ain't going to change anything. It wouldn't have changed Vegas. But if we give it, right, and you say, fine, you got that one. All right. Now, if you decide we're going to fall on our sword, on our Second Amendment sword, and say, we're going to defend this one to the death, we might or might not win. But even if we do win, we'll have spent a lot of time and energy defending something that, as you and I have already talked about, isn't really worth much. To we who believe in the Second Amendment and in the right to keep and bear arms. It's saying, I want to be able to hang on to the right to have a device that takes one of my firearms and makes it mimic something that has been illegal for 30 years under a law signed by a rep. It seems like a dumb thing to defend. And we've all seen people defend dumb things and arguments, and they usually end up looking stupid. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails. We'll get back to those calls in just a moment, but it's a real pleasure to welcome back to my program Nigel Jaques, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He writes for Willamette Week. You can find his stories at wweek.com. And Nigel, you have identified a story that probably could apply to almost any city in America. In this case, you're writing about Portland, and you point out that every 7 minutes, 365 days a year, a fire crew, often four firefighters in a very expensive vehicle, and a two-person ambulance respond to all medical calls. That means six highly trained, well-compensated first responders going to incidents, lights and siren. Sometimes it's necessary, car crashes, heart attacks, other things. But you say that nearly a third of the 90,000 annual calls for medical service are not emergencies and do not require a response by firefighters. That would be a tremendous savings if in personnel and time, if you did not send the full turnout to every single one of those.
Yeah, it's. I think probably everybody who's listening today has driven by an incident and wondered, why are there so many first responders on the scene? It's a really inefficient approach that we've used in Portland long after other cities have moved to other approaches. There are places in Texas and in California, for instance, where instead of sending four firefighters, they'll send one paramedic on a motorcycle with a medical kit, or they'll send oftentimes an SUV with two people. And we're doing a little bit of that here, but not very much. So Portland a few years ago, I did a story about, was then the only city in the country that still sent four firefighters on a fire rig to every medical call. And so it's expensive. I mean, those guys are well paid. They're highly trained. The equipment that they drive, those trucks and engines can easily cost more than $1 million a piece. And so obviously rolling them puts wear and tear on them. And, you know, some of these calls are life threatening, but most of them are not.
And it also means that, you know, you got these substitution goods in economic terms. If you run the fire rig on one call, it's not available for the call where the rig might actually be of some great use.
Yeah, you know, firefighters will point out that there are many times or sometimes that they're waiting for the ambulance to show up, and at the same time they're waiting for the ambulance to show up, they feel they call that says, hey, we need you urgently at a fire. Well, they can't leave until the ambulance arrives. So but there are a variety of inefficiencies in the way that we currently operate. People have identified those for years, but they haven't changed. And so the county, Multnomah County, is in charge of the ambulance service. They've got a request for proposals currently open, and they're trying to make big changes, but it's a system that is difficult to change.
I mean, I do understand, and I've covered firefighters for a good part of my career, and when I've talked to them about MVAs, motor vehicle accidents, they'll say oftentimes in a motor vehicle accident, it's not just the injured people, it's the broken glass that's on the highway or street, it's the spilled gasoline or diesel that may be a fire hazard, it's the jaws of life that allow them to open up at a car that a regular ambulance typically does not carry. In fact, I don't think they carry them at all. And so there are some things, some calls where it makes sense to put a fire rig on scene, but I'll bet there are others where it doesn't. As you say, it ties up a rig. It may mean that you'll have to staff more rigs and more personnel because you have to assume that some of the time the fire rig is going to be tied up unnecessarily on one thing when they should be rolling on something else.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that there are very serious incidents at which it's critical to have firefighters respond. Everybody agrees on that. Nobody would dispute that. The number that is in the story is that the county and other experts around the country would tell you that there are 25,000 calls that they will respond to this year. That is, that firefighters will respond to this year, that they simply don't need to be at because they're not car crashes or heart attacks or shootings or stabbings. They're, you know, routine medical calls where nobody's going to die, where somebody may be in some discomfort, but they won't be any worse if somebody comes in 20 minutes and, you know, no need to roll firefighters and ambulances with sirens flashing that disrupt traffic and that scare people. So it's a question of trying to modernize the approach. You know, for a long time, they just responded to every call no matter what because they had the capacity to. And, you know, you see in the story that the number of calls over the last 15 years has doubled, basically. And what we're doing doesn't make sense.
Well, tell me this. What's the reception this idea is getting, that there may be a way to dispatch rigs differently and save some public resources and maybe spend them on something that's more important? I don't mean outside the fire service. It might even be that by saving money within the fire service by not rolling on unneeded calls, that you might have the money to buy better equipment or better training or better anything.
Well, the fire chiefs from Portland and Gresham and the fire unions from Portland and Gresham have raised a lot of concerns, which is somewhat surprising. They were involved in they've been talking about this with the county for over a year, and it's clear from documents the county produced for my public records request that there's nothing in the RFP that wasn't discussed, nothing in the request for proposals for a new 10-year ambulance contract that wasn't discussed at great length over the past year. But the fire bureaus in both Portland and Gresham are very upset. They don't like the idea of bringing in sort of a new 911. The way this would have to work is you get a new 911 focus where instead of just making very general assignments of of first responders. You make very specific, you ask very, very specific questions so you can decide who needs to be there. That way, if it's a serious accident, you still do get six people, a minimum of six people responding. But if it's, you know, somebody fell off a chair and needs help getting back in that chair, it's going to be two people responding. They don't like it. They really don't like it. The union that represents the Bureau of Emergency Communications, which is a city agency that handles all 911 calls, they don't like it either because this could threaten the way they currently do business. So changing the status quo, as you know, is extremely hard, and they're going to be winners and losers. And I think the fire bureaus, they would like to do fewer calls because they know that they're not needed on many of those calls, but they worry that if they're doing fewer calls, people may want to cut their budgets rather than redeploying that money in a way that they would like.
I also liked your idea of dispatch on, say, motorcycles or smaller vehicles, only because I've seen it in other countries, and I saw an ambulance, or not an ambulance, but a guy on a motorcycle with medical rig and lights and the gear apparently with him, and I thought, boy, if you were getting around any kind of, you know, good-sized city, even a smaller city with traffic the way it is, if you're on a motorcycle, you may be able to reach the scene a lot faster because of traffic. Even with lights and siren, you can only clear people out of the way so fast. And I've often thought that, you know, if you got into a motor vehicle accident on Interstate 5 in Seattle or Portland or I-90 in Spokane or in Eugene, I-5, that if you could zip up between cars or alongside cars, you might be able to get that first responder to the injured person. If it's 2 minutes faster and the person's bleeding or not breathing or has a heart that stopped, those 2 minutes literally could be a lifesaver. And if you have to wait until this rather large fire rig makes its way to an MVA, that could be a big problem.
Yeah, that's what you're seeing in cities that have a lot worse traffic and that are bigger than Portland geographically, is you're seeing motorcycles do what they call lane splitting, where they do drive in between two lanes of traffic or along the emergency strip on the outside. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the calls that firefighters are responding to these days are drug overdoses. And, that's unpleasant and nobody wants to talk about it, but it's reality. And often the first response to a drug overdose these days is to get some Narcan into the person who's overdosed.
Yep.
And that is exactly what one person on a motorcycle is able to do. So I think what the county is saying is, hey, other people are doing things differently. They're doing things more efficiently and they're having good outcomes. So why don't we try it? And fire bureaus aren't so sure.
Nigel, it's a pleasure to have you on. You can find his story at WWeek.com, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Lars.
You bet. Glad to have you with me on a Wednesday live on the Radio Northwest Network. Your calls at 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today has to do with bump stocks. Should they be made illegal? To me, I can't find a good reason to defend them, so I would say yes, perhaps we should. Whether or not it works out for conservatives and Second Amendment fans like us, politically or not, I think it's a sensible thing to do. Our Twitter poll is brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, gravel, sand, and topsoil. Let the Dan Jones trucks put it where you want it and save your aching back. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. Boy, I'm getting a lot of response by email about, not just the fire department, but also about this bump stock question. Bill Meyer, who's my buddy who does Talk Down in Southern Oregon on KMED, one of our great affiliates, says, Lars, the Second Amendment is ultimately the right to fight your government if needed. We don't like to think about that, but the tyranny our founders faced was soft compared to the all-seeing, all-powerful Leviathan that is currently ensconced in D.C. I'll go against the herd and say Reagan was wrong to sign the 86 bill outlawing full auto for civilians. We're supposedly the masters of our government. How can we be the masters of an institution that claims authority to disarm, to arm more weakly its supposed bosses? If anything, the murderous acts of Paddock, Stephen Paddock, demonstrate the reason the government agents demand and have the effectiveness of full auto at their disposal. We should not give an inch. Signed Bill. Let's go to a naysayer Thor in Bremerton listening on KGMI. I'm sorry, on KVI. Thor, welcome to the program. What do we disagree about?
Hey, Lars. My question is, we can't keep passing these laws and nobody goes back and actually enforces them. If you look at the Washington state statute that outlaws automatic weapons, the one that goes past what the federal government does.
Yep. I'm subject to it.
All right. Well, it states what? It says it's illegal to modify a gun to fire more than X number of rounds a minute.
Yep.
Pretty simple. So by that definition, the slide fire is already dead.
Well, I haven't ever seen them make that argument, although I guess they could in court and charge you for owning a slide fire saying that you've modified the gun. I think, a clever lawyer, and I'm not one, would make the argument that you haven't actually modified the gun. You've done something on the outside of the gun that doesn't actually modify the inside of the gun. And maybe that would work, maybe it wouldn't. Frankly, I don't care about the bump fire, the bump stocks.
Yeah, I don't either.
I agree with you. I think it is redundant. But here's the point I'd make. Almost everybody in this argument sees it from the extremes. Those of us who really care about the Second Amendment see it from that extreme. The folks who think that all guns are evil see it from that extreme. Do you know where wins and losses in voting and members of Congress and presidents come? They don't come at the extremes. They come in the middle. They come in the middle by the people who they don't care one way or the other a whole lot. And they're right in the middle of America. And you can see that Donald Trump captured a lot of the middle of America while Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders stuck to the extremes. And the only reason I say that is this isn't about winning and losing, but it is about a system we have for making decisions. If you want the votes in those, you need to look reasonable and take reasonable positions according not to our extreme view on the edges, but to the people in the middle. And I think you can get there with this. Now, I understand all the people writing me saying, Lars, you're saying you're going to give them a gimme. We'll never get it paid back. I'm not looking to get it paid back by Nancy Pelosi. She's never going to be pro-gun. Or Hillary Clinton. She's never going to be pro-gun. Or Jay Inslee. But the voter in the middle is going to say, well, the Republicans gave on this. And you folks haven't given on anything. Because the Democrats tend not to give on anything. You've noticed that on Obamacare, they haven't jumped forward and said, hey, listen, we could do something that would help fix America's health care problem or tax issues or foreign policy or anything. They don't give on anything. And instead, they're able to paint us with a brush that says Republicans don't give on anything. This seems like a reasonable place to say, OK, you can have this one.
Good point.
Okay. Yeah, I do. Let's bring up Donald Trump live at the hospital. Thank you very much for the call. He went by to meet with some of the folks who had, who were affected by the murderous crimes on Sunday night.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Radio
should be played at high volume.
This is the Lars Larson Show, broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
When enough people make false promises, words stop meaning anything.
This is honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
We meet at a time of both immense promise and great peril.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Let's just swipe left on Lars Larson. Some dignity back in the White House.
On FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails shortly. I love the opportunity to talk to Dr. Sebastian Gorka, a former White House deputy assistant to President Donald Trump, now the chief strategist for the MAGA coalition, Make America Great Again, and the vice president of the Institute of World Politics and the author most recently of Defeating Jihad. Dr. Gorka, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
Now, on Monday, when we started to try to deconstruct and figure out what had happened Sunday night when this killer had decided to murder people, Stephen Paddock, murdering people wholesale in Las Vegas, sending 59 people to their deaths, more than 500 to the hospital. One of the earliest claims we heard on Monday morning was that the Islamic State had claimed credit for this act of terrorism. And then very quickly, the FBI stepped forward and said, no, we see no connection whatsoever. We don't think it's there. I wanted to get your take on that and what it means that the Islamic State was trying to claim credit for the mass murder in Las Vegas.
Well, ISIS often claims credit very rapidly, which is not the case with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda took a very long time to claim September 11th, for example. However, there have been at least two cases recently, one in France and one in Southeast Asia, where ISIS claimed an attack which did not, in fact, turn out to be connected to them. So we shall see. Remember, it's just a few days into this investigation. The FBI may have said what they said, but the deputy sheriff yesterday, the undersheriff, stated they have not ruled anything out and they have not ruled anything in. So let's just wait and see. What I do find, I absolutely abhor conspiracy theorists, and I don't give in to conspiracy theories, but I am disturbed that we are several days into this investigation and there is basically no comment, zero comment, no information about the political identity of this individual, nothing about social media, no information from his friends or relatives about which way this man leant politically. I find that a little bit odd.
I find it odd too, Dr. Gorka, although I guess I'd go back, other than his girlfriend, the most proximate source of information about him might be his brother, even though his brother lived in Florida and Stephen Pollack lived in Vegas, or Paddock, I should say, Stephen Paddock. But his brother said that he was kind of apolitical. And frankly, Dr. Gorka, you and I immerse ourselves in politics because we understand that politics reaches into almost every part of everybody's life, one way or another, the decisions about what kind of job you can have or what you can do and your liberties and all that. But there are an awful lot of people in America, I think, who aren't that concerned with politics one way or the other. Or they figure, you know, I don't really have any way to influence it one way or the other, so I'll vote. But other than that, I'm not very politically involved. Is it possible that he's one of those people in America that I think are very common who didn't really get involved in politics one way or the other?
I sincerely doubt it. Yes, you're right. I think the vast majority of American citizens aren't addicted to politics like you or I are, don't follow politics as closely as people who live in the worlds that we live in. But whether or not, so if this person was a terrorist, there's no way he didn't have a political identity. That by itself is an oxymoron. And if he was psychotic, if this is a serial killer, likewise, there's no way. The idea that he was politically neutral but then psychotic like Charles Manson, it just I don't buy it. So either way, there has to be. And look, I don't go to the families of mass murderers for reliable information. We saw this with the San Bernardino killers. We saw this with the Boston bombers. For me, that's not where you get highly credible information right after an attack or after atrocity. So, no, I think the scenario that this person has had a neutral or non-existent political identity and then killed 58 people, I don't buy it.
No, and in fact, it's made us suspicious that he has a girlfriend who hails from the Philippines. She has family there, and apparently he fairly recently transferred $100,000 to the Philippines. He was a millionaire, multimillionaire, and he was able to do it, but sending $100,000 down to the Philippines when the Philippines have such a known history of involvement with Islam or Islamic groups within the Philippines, that made it suspicious as well.
Right. So, again, let's give time to the investigators to find out what's really going on here with that transfer and with the connections to the Philippines. Philippines is a predominantly Catholic Christian nation, but it is riven by a jihadi terrorism. It's right next to Indonesia, the biggest Muslim nation in the world. They have Abu Sayyaf, a jihadi group which has aligned itself with ISIS. The city of Marawi has been under siege by ISIS for a very, very long time. So, yes, it does raise the suspicions of some kind of terrorist connection, but just having a Filipino wife and wiring a large amount of money, that's not a slam dunk yet. So let's wait and see as to what those leads actually drive to eventually.
Well, and if some Islamic group, Dr. Gorka, has managed to radicalize a 64-year-old, fairly conventional, although wealthy, American citizen to go out and commit acts of violence on its behalf, what are the implications of that?
yeah, this is very, this is the potentially the strangest aspect of all. If this does turn out to be jihadi terrorism, in the last 3 years, if we look at all the plots executed in the U.S. jihadi plots, successful or otherwise, more than 60% of the perpetrators or planned perpetrators were between 16 or 26. So the age cohort is almost always very, very young males. If this is a terrorist attack, it would be a real outlier and hopefully not indicative of a new trend in terms of domestic recruitment.
Well, and if it turns out that there is that kind of connection, how willing are the federal agencies or local law enforcement going to be to share that with the public?
You mean if it turns out to be terrorism?
Yeah, if it turns out to be terrorism, other than the conventional definition of terrorism, that murdering a lot of people is something that terrorizes people. But if we understand that this is maybe has a political agenda to it or some kind of cause agenda to it, are the authorities going to be likely to want to tell the public about that?
I don't care. They're duty bound to do so. They took an oath to the nation. They took an oath to the bad. They took an oath to the state in which they serve, if they're state or local. And if we see the perversion of justice by keeping key facts out of the general reporting, I think that would be a travesty. I don't worry. I think that a lot of negative things, bad things have happened with the FBI in recent months. I think most of those are politically driven and not necessarily concerned with national security in the counterterrorism field. But I have great faith. I watched the press conference yesterday with the undersheriff, with the coroner. Those are incredibly... They looked very professional under great, great strain and stress, and I expect them to do their duty as anyone who wears a badge and wears the cloth of the Republic is expected to do.
Dr. Sebastian Gorka is the author most recently of Defeating Jihad. He's currently with the Institute of World Politics, and he's the chief strategist for MAGA. The MAGA coalition is Make America Great Again. Dr. Gorka, thanks for the time today.
My pleasure, Lars. God bless.
God bless you as well. Back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails and the issues of the day. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Glad to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout the states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, a little bit of Northern California, and even a little bit of Southern BC. If you'd like to jump into the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Yesterday, and I know it sounded like a stupid question, but I asked, should Northwest daycares be required to test water for lead? They are required to do that in Washington State. Oregon says too darned expensive for those daycares. I mean, $60 to $90 to test for lead in the water at a daycare. Oregon doesn't think it's too expensive to raise the minimum wage by 30 or 40 or 50%. That raises the cost of the daycare. But boy, an extra $60 to $90 once or twice a year, that'll just break the bank. Well, 82% of you said yes, they should be required to test. That was my group. Only 18% of you said no. Our Twitter poll today, found at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or LarsLarson.com on the internet, should we make bump stocks that turn or allow semi-automatics to mimic full automatics illegal? I would answer yes on that. And I think it's an easy call. I'm going to take some naysayers, then I'll get to the rest of your calls. Ben's on the line in Everett, listening on KVI. Hey, Ben, where do you and I disagree?
Well, Lars, I love the show, first-time caller, but I got to disagree that to make these bump ski stocks illegal, I got to disagree with you there. One of the reasons for me is it's not really an argument of making this accessory or something illegal, because you can bump fire a semi-automatic rifle and have the same full auto mimicking effect with or without the stock.
Absolutely right. And I pointed that out early, which means whether somebody can manufacture the device and sell it or not, people will be able to do it. So then what's the reason for us to say this is an important issue for us to fight against the illegalization, the non-legalization of bump fire devices?
Because I think that the counterargument would have to be they'd have to legislate how a person is allowed to handle or even shoot the firearm that they own. And who wants the government or anyone else telling them how
they can or cannot use
items. No, I don't, and I catch your argument, but I think all they're talking about is saying, if you're a company, you cannot manufacture this device and sell it. And it may, they could, depending on how it's written, say, you're not even allowed as an individual to go out and make one of your own homemade bump fire devices or bump stocks. But I think that would be incredibly hard to enforce.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, and you don't need a device at all. You can bump it with practice. And obviously this guy maybe did some practice or put at least a lot of preparation in what he did here in Las Vegas. But with practice and preparation, you can have the same effect without modifying the gun, taking it straight out of the box from the store and bump fire it in the same way.
That's a very good point. Ben, thanks a lot for the call. Good naysayer. Brian's on the line. Brian, you're also a naysayer. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Again, just like the other caller, love your show, and I'm always agreeing with you on everything. But if we start, you know, making these illegal, what about the three-round burst? I mean, that's just three rounds per pull. Or, you know, if you want to get technical, once they start...
Well, actually, I don't know that you can... A three-round burst weapon is viewed as an automatic versus semi-automatic. I don't know that you can buy a three-round burst today, can you? I didn't think you could.
I haven't looked into it one time.
Oh, no, my understanding is the three-round burst is military and law enforcement only. That's covered under the 1986 ban that Reagan signed against automatic weapons.
Okay, I understand that point. But, you know, a lot of deaths the cars going speeding down the road of killing people. So we're going to make cars that don't go over 65, 70. I mean, the bump stock did not kill these people in Vegas.
I agree.
My heart and my prayers are with these families and people. And I wish that guy didn't kill himself so he could be in our court system right now and see what he did. But that's just taking rights away. I mean, that's just something.
Well, except that's where, Brian, when I wrestle with a lot of issues before I bring them up on the show. And I thought to myself, what's the argument I'm going to use that this has directly to do with the Second Amendment? And I can't find it. I think the number of rounds you can put in a magazine is directly related to the gun. And that could be viewed as an accessory as well. But when I looked at it, I thought, am I going to follow my sword on this one? And the answer was no. I explained to people at great length yesterday that Stephen Paddock would have been just as deadly on Sunday night with a semi-automatic rifle as he was with a rifle equipped with a bump stock. And people said, well, that can't be. And I said, well, you've never fired one of the rifles. Go out to a range. I mean, if you really wanted to do a grim kind of comparison, fire a bump stock weapon and fire off 500 rounds. And you'll have to change magazines a bunch of times. And when you're all done, see how many minutes have gone by. And then do the same thing with an ordinary semi-automatic rifle. The difference will be a couple of minutes. The number of minutes that people had their lives at risk was 15, 20 minutes. I think that the actual gunfire lasted for about 11. But there were people in exposed positions for a long time. If he'd sat up there for the 10 or 11 minutes that he was firing with a bump stock and simply fired one trigger pull at a time, he probably would have shot about the same number of rounds. I know that people find the sound much more frightening, but the deadliness of the bullet... If you can fire 500 or 600 rounds in 10 minutes, and I can tell you can, and you can fire 500 or 600 rounds or 800 rounds with a bump fire, the difference is academic. You're just as deadly with both kinds of guns. And so I've told people that, which makes it all the easier for me to say, who cares about the bump fire?
You know what? You're very level-headed, and after listening to that, I'm with you on that, you know. You make good sense and keep on going, man.
Thanks. Well, thank you, and I appreciate it. Here's the thing. Tell Jay Inslee, you want to ban him? Fine. One person already made the argument that in Washington State, since it's illegal to modify any kind of semi-automatic rifle to fire in a form where you get multiple rounds one after the other, you could even argue that the bump fire stocks are already illegal in the state of Washington. So... if you've decided that Second Amendment rights are important, do you really want to say this is so important that we take on a device that's very rare, that's not as, and frankly, I don't know many people who want to take their gun and modify it this way, but is it part of the Second Amendment, or is it something, an odd little curiosity that allows you to create the effect of a full automatic weapon, which is illegal in America. I don't even hear an awful lot of people. Well, Bill Myers made the argument when he wrote into me a little while ago saying we never should have given that up in 1986. But what I'd like to be able to say to the middle of America, the apolitical America, is to say we're not on the fringes. We're willing, when there is a sensible argument made that maybe this device is not something we want to allow to be manufactured, you give them that, and you're not giving it to the far fringe. You're giving it to the middle of America and making the argument to them that we, as Second Amendment-believing Americans, are willing to be reasonable when it comes to things like that. Like the Democrats could be reasonable on partial birth abortion, and they never are because they don't even like partial birth abortion, but they say, we can't give it up. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. Don't forget, every Friday we celebrate First Amendment Friday on this program, so we let you set the agenda that day, although I always bring some things to the table, too. Jerry's on the line in Olympia listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Hey, I've been a firefighter paramedic for 20 years up in the Western Washington here, and everything your guest said was true about the inefficiencies. But there is a reason why this efficiency is built in.
Let me, Jerry, for people who didn't hear the interview because it was almost an hour ago, we had this Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Nigel Jaquess. He's a very smart guy, and he pointed out that in Portland, unlike a lot of cities, they run a full fire rig with four firefighter / EMTs on it and an ambulance with usually two personnel on it to every one of the 90,000 calls. And about a third of those, about 30,000 of those calls, are not the kind of situation that would merit that full six personnel and two large expensive rigs running. And they've suggested maybe we should change the way that we dispatch things like that. Do you think there's a justification for keeping it the way it is?
Well, I don't think it's a legitimate justification, but there is a reason that they're doing it. And our department runs the same way. And the reason they do it this way is because if they dispatch a call at an advanced level, you get that large response. But just on that dispatch, that allows the departments to bill for the transport they do at the advanced life support rate and therefore get the federal reimbursements and the state reimbursements at paid at a higher rate.
Although there may be a slight difference in Portland because the fire bureau does not transport. Ambulances transport. And so it's kind of weird in that way. Let me ask you if it's something.
In Washington, it's different.
Is it? So fire department can do transport.
Oh, a lot of them do. A good portion of them do, all except maybe the biggest cities do. But where I work, they've changed our dispatching system to dispatch everything advanced so that we get a higher reimbursement. And that's, you're talking about 20,000 transports.
See, and we should, do you
at,
think.
At $1,000 a piece.
Yeah, do you think as a taxpayer that it makes sense to say, whatever way we do it, let's do it the most expensive way? Then you're driven not by medical need, but by dollars.
No, it's by dollars. And the earlier subject about unions, the unions are involved in this. The leadership of the department's all been usually union guys. I mean, it's kind of an incestuous relationship amongst the group here. But our actions at my department are driven by reimbursement, and the dispatch centers are controlled up in Washington usually by the user groups, so all the fire departments. That's who sets the dispatch protocols, and then so we get this over dispatching in order to be able to get higher reimbursements, even if a patient goes in a basic life support situation, we're getting reimbursed at an advanced life support rate.
Well, let me ask you this, too, because Jerry, I mean, if you see what I think about is I want people to think out of the box, and I want them to think of new ideas where, you know, if we do things differently, it might come out better. There are a lot of examples of that in our society. Everybody thinks, well, you know, we're not going to reinvent the wheel. Sometimes you do reinvent the wheel. You figure out a different way of doing things that actually works better for everyone. So, for example,
absolutely,
if you get an MVA on Interstate 5 where it runs through Olympia, big motor vehicle accident, you're going to say, we need a fire truck there. There's likely to be spilled gas. There's likely to be, you know, glass on the pavement. There's likely to be people hurt in various ways. You may need the jaws of life, the hearse tool and all that stuff. Ambulances don't have that. So I think that makes sense.
Yep.
But,
go ahead.
But if you got a call, and I'll bet you get calls from time to time, I'm pulled over on the side of I-5. My husband's having a heart attack. In that case, the idea of one paramedic with the right equipment on a motorcycle going up five, can he get there 2 minutes sooner? You know what the difference of 2 minutes is if somebody's having a heart attack. It can be the difference between a dead body and a live body. And on the other hand, getting a fire rig up I-5 during rush hour may be really problematic.
Oh, it's extremely difficult, especially in rush hour.
I mean, we all watch for your lights and siren, but you could, you know, there are times I've been sitting there in three lanes of traffic and everybody tries to scooch over, you know, and get 6 inches from the next car, and you think, I can't get over any farther. I hope there's enough room for the rig to get by. We all want to get out of your way, but sometimes it's really tough.
Yeah, on these advanced calls like you're describing here, there is a need for more manpower in those calls, or just because of the severity of the situation, there's a lot of procedures that need to be done as far as 12-lead EKGs, IVs, setup for those things. We're also dealing with a larger population in terms of body size that requires more manpower.
Uh-huh.
there's several things that play into this. And a big portion of the malfunction is just society as a whole, the lack of people being able to deal with the basics of life. The millennial generation, I'll use as a good example. People call 911 for the most ridiculous reasons, and that accounts for a huge portion of calls that are just not necessary for a 911.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, for instance, if you or I got cut badly, I mean, even if I was by myself, I'd say, well, I'm going to put pressure on it. I'm going to wrap it up in something. And unless I feel lightheaded, I might even jump in my car and drive to the hospital that's a mile up the road from my house. You don't expect a heart attack victim to do that, and it would be stupid. But you're saying that a lot of millennials are just, they don't even know what to do on the simplest of stuff.
Oh, yeah, and they call 911 for everything. And where I work, I don't work in Olympia, just to be clear.
Okay.
Where I work, we have a huge mentally ill population. They call constantly. We have a huge problem with drugs on the streets and homelessness. They're calling all the time. So there's a lot of waste that's built into the system just because of people not being unwilling to handle the most basic of needs for themselves.
Now, the other piece of this, Jerry, that I wanted to use, how long have you been a firefighter?
20 years.
What's happened to fire calls specifically over the last 20 years?
Well, we're predominantly a medical.
Right.
Medical.
So it used to be you ran on a lot of fires. These days you run on a whole lot more medical calls, right?
At least 80% is our.
See, and I still want your guys to be fully equipped, because when your house catches fire, you got to have the fire department come, and they generally need four guys on the rig. One to drop at the hydrant and hook up. The other three go with the rig. One guy jumps off and grabs a hose, and if he can, goes in, or maybe even two of them go in, one to back up the other one to do life, you know, to do rescue if somebody's trapped in that house. And somebody's got to start up that pump and do all those other things. You need four guys on a rig, from what I understand from the firefighters I know. You cut it to three, like some departments will say, oh, we'll save money, we'll just put three guys on a rig. It doesn't work out very well, because then you end up literally shorthanded in those first few minutes. And I wonder whether over the last 30 or 40 years, the dramatic drop off in house fires has diminished that as a cause. And then if you were to drop off on certain medical calls, like Nigel's story suggested, maybe as many as 30%, all of a sudden you're losing an awful lot of the justification for the agency. But we still need the full agency and its full capabilities for when there is a medical emergency that requires fire response, and there's a medical call that requires, you know, six guys on scene at the same time. I mean, I don't want to lose that capability because the folks at City Hall decide, well, if there aren't as many medical calls and there aren't as many fires, we can cut the fire department, because I think that would be foolish.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Although the fire calls have decreased over the years, the regulations have increased over the years. So our NFPA requirements, national requirements. So we're required to have a certain amount of folks on every fire. We can't even make entry in through the door unless you have what's called two in, two out, which is you have to have backup crews, you have to have the pump operator, you have to have the officer, you basically have to have multiple engine companies to make entry onto a fire anymore.
Now tell me the truth, Jerry. Jerry, have you ever run into a burning building without a guy behind you to back you up?
Oh, yeah.
And that's why we love firefighters, because the rules say you got to have two, but there's somebody in that, you think there's somebody in that house, you guys go in anyway.
Yeah, we all get into this to, you know, for the right reasons, and it And if you, you know, somebody, if you don't have the manpower, you're going to do what you got to do.
You don't just stand outside and let people die inside of a house that you could say.
No, no, it's, I mean, you're, you know, we're all kind of type A people. We're go-getters, and we're going to make an effort to save someone if we can.
Jerry, I appreciate the phone call, and thanks for what you do as a firefighter. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
They come seeking a better life.
Illegal immigration.
And they do it illegally.
I am an illegal alien.
They use your health care, drive on your roads, use your schools, and take your jobs.
My fellow Americans and our millions of illegal aliens.
And hey, they do it illegally.
Do you know the cost of illegal immigration?
It's time for Lars's Illegal Play of the Day.
Oh, this is great news. Let me read it right off the alert that came from The Hill on Capitol Hill. The House Homeland Security Committee today approved a border security bill that includes $10 billion, that's billion with a B, for a border wall. The Border Security for America Act, proposed by Committee Chair Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, passed along party lines. The Democrats do not like the idea of a wall. Just remember that in the election time next November. The bill now heads to the House floor amid debate over whether border security provisions should be attached to potential legislation to protect the dear dreamers, the DACA kids out there. Yeah, well, I don't want that part of it, but I sure like the part that allows $10 billion for a border wall. It'll be one of the best investments America has made. And remember, walls last a long, long time. Just ask China. Let's go to Tom, who's a naysayer. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, good to talk to you. Hey, can I ask you a question in aid of my argument?
I do it all the time, so of course you can do it.
What is the definition, the ATF definition, of a semi-automatic rifle versus a fully automatic machine gun?
A semi-automatic rifle fires one shot for every trigger pull. A full automatic machine gun fires multiple shots for every trigger pull. You pull down the trigger and either get a three-round burst, or the gun fires until it runs out of ammunition, or until your finger lifts. Yeah.
Now, the thing is, the slide fire, the bump fire, fits the ATF's definition of a semi-automatic rifle.
Yes, it does.
If you make that illegal, you're murking the waters. You're kind of opening Pandora's box of what's legal and what's not.
Okay, the only way I would do it, only way I would do it is if you wrote it as it is illegal to make or sell a device that is designed to cause a semi-automatic rifle to mimic a full automatic rifle. Does that make sense? So if you say it has to be an add-on.
Well, that makes sense, but I can mimic it with my finger if I'm fast enough.
Well, but your finger is not, your finger was manufactured by God, and thank God the Congress has no authority over God's manufacturing process, although the transgender advocates would have you believe that God gets it wrong all the time, and you have to go, we had to go there, and I thought, well, as long as, and maybe we get Republicans to add the line, unless manufactured by God, in which case you can pull the finger as fast as you can.
I feel like once you do that, you're really murking the waters and you're taking away from the legal definitions to more of a feeling. The next thing you know, it'll be drum mags and third round mags, and you're really kind of murking the waters on what you can get away with.
Well, I hope you're wrong about that. I just saw this as an opportunity to say, all right, most of us don't care about this. And again, I care about gun legislation on guns that I don't own. Don't get me wrong. It's not because I don't own one. As I said, I've had a couple of companies give me these devices. I just have no interest in them. And frankly, since you mentioned that argument, technically, what Stephen Paddock used the other day was still a semi-automatic rifle, right?
Yes, he did. Yeah, it was still illegal.
One shot per pull.
Correct.
So, but, you know, I guess I love seeing the Democrats tie themselves up in knots on stuff like this, where they're advocating for something, and when you point out to them, this will make zero difference to mass murder in America, and they don't get it. Most of them have never been to a gun range. They don't know anything about it. And I'm telling you, as unpleasant as it is to think about it, if Stephen Paddock had sat in that room with an ordinary semi-automatic without the bump fire stock, he would have been just as deadly. No less deadly than he was with the device. So making it illegal will change nothing, but I guess if it floats their boat, fine, go ahead. Let's go to Sam. Hey, Sam, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Thanks for taking my call. First, I guess anytime we give in to the liberals or anything, if we give them an inch, they take a mile.
That's true.
And
or they try.
Or they try, yeah. And, you know, we'll make deals with them, and then, you know, they'll make a contingent. Well, you give up this, and then, you know, next year or 5 years down the road, we'll give up that. Well, when we get to that 5 years down the road, they don't give up.
Well, and except they do. Sam, can I point out they do give up? And let me give you two good examples. 6 years ago, President Barack Obama, thank God he's no longer president, had an all-Democrat Congress, and he couldn't get gun legislation passed. Today, as we're standing here, Governor Kate Brown has a Democrat legislature. She has a supermajority in one house of the legislature and one vote short of a supermajority, and they've already announced that they've given up, thank God, on new gun legislation for Oregon. So when you say they don't give up, I think they do. They gave up during the entire 8 years of Obama. They have given up in the Oregon legislature. I think they may realize that they're trying to, you know, this road is just not going to work for them. Even when they have the majorities in hand, it doesn't work for them. And I'm glad to see them give up. I wish they would start understanding the real solution here is to take the laws you already have on the books and thoroughly enforce them and throw the book at people who commit crimes with guns. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Please, ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
You're ready.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
All of this could have been avoided if we'd followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop the hammering. Stop the hammering out there. Who's got a hammer?
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Be sure and keep that volume up.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Glad to be live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout Oregon, Washington, Idaho, parts of Canada, even parts of Northern California. And your phone calls are welcome. And as you see, we have for more than 20 years on this program welcomed naysayers to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Before I go back to your calls, let me mention a couple of stories that I thought were particularly important for the Pacific Northwest. First, on the subject of unions, I saw this headline in the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, and it said, U.S. Supreme Court case could mean financial instability for Oregon public unions, meaning the unions representing government workers. And I thought, why would you write a headline that way? What the Supreme Court case is about is whether or not individual American citizens who have jobs as government employees can be forced by law to pay dues to a union. Now, you could have written the headline, U.S. Supreme Court case could provide worker liberty. It could say that U.S. workers might not have to pay union dues under the Constitution, U.S. Supreme Court to decide. Could have said any of those things, but what does the fish wrapper do? The Daily Dead Fish Wrapper frames it as though their biggest concern is the fate of unions, not the fate of average citizens who have jobs as government employees. That's one. The other one I kind of mentioned in passing yesterday, in this whole argument that I hear from people who say, well, you've got to do something about Vegas, so let's pass a bump stock ban. Okay, I've already said, give the Democrats that one. It's an easy gimme. And I know some of you disagree, and I accept your arguments that you disagree. My argument has always been, enforce the laws you already have. Now, that sounds kind of empty unless I give you a specific example of a law that could be enforced that we already have on the books. Because usually the folks, politicians and others, even Second Amendment advocates, will leave it at enforce the laws you already have, and then if those are not sufficient, we'll consider other laws. So let me give you a specific example, and I mentioned this from memory yesterday, and I got a couple of small numbers wrong. But I want to read you a press release from 3 years ago this month. It says, on October 1st, 2014, Charles Thornton, 39 years old, hometown of Patterson, California, was sentenced by U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken. She's from Eugene. She's a liberal. Actually, my producer and I flew on the same airplane as she did, and she ended up sitting next to Carl. Can you imagine her surprise when she said, so what do you do for a living? And he said, I'm the producer, the executive producer for the Lars Larson Show. And I think her jaw just about dropped off. But we love talking to her. We wish that Ann Aiken would come on the program. I'd love to ask her about this guy. Charles Thornton, 39 years ago, 3 years ago, he was sentenced to federal prison for his role in a firearm straw purchase and trafficking investigation. Here's what it says. In August of 2008, Thornton, a felon and crack cocaine dealer, recruited a woman named Elizabeth Arsenault, a crack cocaine customer of his, to buy firearms from him or for him from various firearms dealers in Southern Oregon. Thornton needed others to buy the firearms because, as a felon, he was prohibited from doing so. Purchases of guns in this manner, where the actual purchaser conceals his involvement from the seller of the firearm, are commonly known as straw purchases. Firearm straw purchasing offenses are particularly reprehensible because those firearms often end up, I would say usually end up, in the hands of people who are not lawfully allowed to possess them, and they are regularly used in violent crimes. This is off a press release from ATF 3 years ago. Over the next few months, Arsenault acted as a straw purchaser, purchasing approximately 35 firearms for Thornton and others. Now, they convicted the guy of this. They sent him to prison. So understand that he was doing something. Each one of those purchases was a crime. Every time that woman signed her name to the paperwork to buy it, it was a crime by her. Every time he arranged for the purchase, it was a crime by him. So for federal judge Ann Aiken, what massive prison sentence did Ann Aiken hand down for Charles Thornton, who had put 35 firearms into the hands of criminals and made a profit while he was doing it? He got 41 months in prison. Now, I've been trying to get the Federal Bureau of Prisons today to tell me, is this guy still even in custody? Because if he was sentenced to 41 months, 3.5 years, about 3 years ago, with good time, he might already be out on the street. But I want you to think about this for a moment. His punishment for making thousands of dollars, maybe even tens of thousands of dollars, by putting guns into the hands of criminals where they could be used. Some of them turned up in the city of Oakland in the hands of criminals. As a matter of fact, it says so in the press release from 3 years ago. He gets an average of 1 month in prison for each of the firearms that he put into the hands of a criminal. And I would ask you to tell me if you disbelieve my assertion. If you're putting a gun into the hands of a criminal, if a criminal is seeking to illegally purchase a gun, what do you think he's most likely to do with it? My theory would be a criminal, a convicted criminal who can't buy a gun on his own, who buys an illegal firearm, is likely to use it. And I don't mean he's likely to use it for target practice at the local gun range. I think he's going to use it in the commission of more crimes. So for that, the guy gets 1 month and a couple of days for each one of those firearms that was illegally purchased and then sold at a profit to other criminals. 1 month. Now, the law does not say 1 month. The law says the judge could have thrown the book at this guy. But she didn't. Now, I remind you, Ann Aiken is a bit of a liberal. She even says she listens to the show. And if Ann Aiken, by the way, guys, if to my producers, if Judge Ann Aiken calls in and wants to talk, we are going to give her all the time she wants to explain 1 month per gun. So when you hear liberals like Ann Aiken, she's a judge, but not necessarily a politician, because remember, as a federal district judge, she's appointed for life. She's got if there's a Democrat administration sometime in America's future, God forbid, she could even rise up the ladder to other federal judge positions. She gives out this tiny little penalty, 35 days or so punishment for each and every illegal firearm put into the hands of a criminal. And then liberals like her run around saying, well, we need some more laws because we can't get these bad guys away from the guns. I would suggest that if people like Ann Aiken, federal judge from Eugene, were to actually use the law to its fullest extent and throw the book at these people. And let me tell you how easy it would be. In this press release, I want you to imagine this. In this press release, it says, at least several of the firearms purchased during this scheme surfaced in crime scenes in Oakland, California, shortly after their purchase. They were put right to work in criminal activity. So if you say, well, how do you catch these people? It must be awfully tough. Let me tell you how easy it could be. Wherever one of these illegal guns shows up, the police go to a crime scene. They shake, you know, they search a prisoner and they find one of these guns. They run the serial number. They find out this serial number is for a gun that was not purchased by the guy you're taking the gun off of, but was purchased by, in this case, Eleanor Arsenault. And you say, I wonder how she came to transfer the gun to this guy. So you go back to the gun store's records and you say, I'd like to know who you sold this to. And they say, well, we sold it to Eleanor Arsenault. You look up Ms. Arsenault and you go find her and you say, we've got the records of several guns found at crime scenes that you bought just a couple of months ago. And you sit her down and you explain to her, if we put you on trial, you may be spending a lot of time behind the Gray Bar Hotel. Okay? You are going to be in big trouble. So you need to roll over on the guy who is getting you to do this because you had a clean criminal record. One way or another, you're going to end up with a criminal record. And one way or another, we're going to find out who you were doing this for and how the guns got to these criminals. And after you sit down with her, I imagine her defense attorney will tell her, you better cop a plea and roll over, because if you don't, you're going to be going to prison for a long, long time. Now, once you make that case, because you've got her signature on the form, in all the gun stores I've ever been to, you've got a copy of her picture ID. You know her home address. You know all those things. So you put together the case very easily, and then you say, we're going to throw the book at you and at the guy who had you doing this for him. She was getting paid off in crack cocaine, it turns out. Now, if you did that, do you think you could make a dent in some of the guns that end up in the hands of people who are often involved in other criminal activity, drugs and other things, and put them behind bars as well? You could do that. The federal judiciary, in some cases local judges, have chosen not to do that. In this case, Charles Thornton got 41 months for putting 35 guns in the hands of convicted criminals. Do you think the punishment could have been a little more than that? Do you think you might have removed this guy from the streets a little longer? Do you think if you came down on the illegal gun trade in America, we're not talking about law-abiding citizens and Second Amendment rights in this case, we're talking about criminals who want to arm themselves so they can shoot and kill people, including their customers, innocent bystanders, their competitors in the drug trade. Do you think you could make a dent in it? I think you could. I think the federal judiciary and some local judges choose not to. And then they say, oh, if you'd only give us one more law, we could make a difference, which I think is a giant pile of Bernie Sanders. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Glad to take your phone calls and emails live on the Radio Northwest Network. 24 radio stations from Spokane all the way to the Washington coast and from Bellingham all the way down to Ashland, Oregon. We're glad to have you with us. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm not in any of those places. I'm in Clearwater, Florida, and listening to you on the Internet.
That happens, too. Thank you for listening. I'm doing very well, sir. Thanks for the call.
I think I was sitting here just amazed what you said about your local newspaper.
The fish wrapper? It is often good for wrapping dead fish or, you know, other garbage. It does. I'm trying to be kind by saying that even if it's good for nothing else, it is good for wrapping up dead fish.
Well, I think what it was about has a lot to do with the fire and rescue. And let me explain it this way.
All right.
I've been in the fire service for 28 years, and as a chief officer, I've been to schools. I mean, I've been to every possible school. I'm state certified. But I was a volunteer. It's an advocation. vocationally as a broadcaster.
Okay, but Jim, I really want you to get to your point because we're burning daylight right now. Where are you going?
Okay, I understand. I was in town for a long time. The problem is this. I was read the newspaper where a paid union firefighter or fire department responded to a house fire in a rather large city. And they responded to this house fire, which is working, fully involved, with two guys on the truck.
Yep, done.
And the city manager came back and said, well, what's good in the budget sheet? Well, here's the problem. Here is the real, real problem. And I've negotiated. I was a chairman of the fire and rescue planning in one of these counties for 17 departments. It's unions. Unions have a rule that says volunteers are not allowed in the same, I'm not going to say every union, here in Florida, volunteers are not allowed to be a member of a union volunteer fire department. Then the Fed comes in and says, well, employment-wise, volunteers cannot be full-time employees of the county. So our county fire service, even though they're trained, they can't volunteer their time unless they're paid. 80% of the United States are volunteers. If you drive from in Florida, 90% of us are volunteers. It's a pipe dream to think that paid firefighters can handle the issues. They can't. Their union has to allow volunteers. When you join volunteers with paid firefighters, the paid firefighters chase the volunteers out. They don't want them there because they're taking union jobs.
I understand that. And by the same token, I mean, I could even see the union perspective. I understand it, even though I may not agree with it, where they say, gosh, if the county has the choice of putting on another 10 volunteers or another 10 paid firefighters, the 10 paid firefighters are going to cost, you know, maybe a million bucks in all total.
Oh, that's with pay minimum. We're dealing with 3 shifts, 7 days a week.
No, you're absolutely right, and unions are a problem. But this problem is a different one, whether or not to send a full-on response to every medical call, even when the fire truck and its extra 4 personnel are not needed. I appreciate the call, Jim. Let's go to a naysayer, Max. Hey, Max, what's on your mind? The bump stock? Hello, Max. Well, Max ain't there, so let's go to David in Washougal. David, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Afternoon, sir. First thing, I'm a huge and proud gun owner for recreation and for hunting. I just want to first start off by saying that.
Okay.
Second thing is that the bump fire stocks and modified bump fire style repeating over-the-counter triggers that you can purchase for any AR-10 or AR-15 platform, I think wholeheartedly should never be allowed for the normal public to have. That's number one. So I completely agree with you there.
All right.
But the biggest thing that nobody is talking about and nobody has brought up is that the state of Nevada, a lot like the state of Oregon, with a class 3, gives any normal upstanding citizen, or I would say above average citizen, because you would also have to have the money to purchase the equipment. But in the state of Oregon and in the state of Nevada, if you have a clean background check and are willing to wait the 6 months or more alongside the money it is to purchase these style of lowers,
yeah,
you can have a fully automatic SBR suppressed out the door.
And I've mentioned that to people, but why is that a problem?
What I think is a problem with that is that you can have a situation like this individual that over the last 2 years has been stockpiling munitions and weaponry with no amount of training. Nothing, just except a clear background check, is able to have a military-grade style arsenal. Not saying that that's what he did have, but that's an avenue with his type of means and funds that he could have gone down.
All right, David, I'm up against a break. I want you to hold through. I don't do this very often, but I want you to do that because I want to ask you a couple of questions in aid of an objection. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866. Hey, Lars, let me go back to David. David, are you there?
Yes, sir.
All right. I held you through, and I want you to describe again what your objection is, what your position is on the whole bump fire and why you think it's bad that some states actually allow citizens under the right conditions to own a fully automatic weapon.
Again, yeah, like I was saying earlier, that the Bumpfire, and there's also a trigger style that you can purchase, again, over the counter or via the internet, that will turn any semi-automatic AR-15, AR-10 platform into to mimic a fully automatic.
Right.
So I, alongside with you, I begrudgingly hate to admit that Jay Inslee is correct, that this is something that we should push through to at least make the manufacturers stop making these.
Right.
There's number one. Now, number two is I do have a position as a legal gun owner and a legal gun owner activist that when it comes to certain states that allow a class three form and a gun trust to be put in place for you to have military grade style arsenal, not only for 15, like a 240 Bravo or any type of H&K platform that would be a belt fed fully automatic weapon.
And you also expressed the concern that a man with means like Stephen Paddock could have acquired some of these to use them in a criminal manner. I guess I'm not that concerned about it because the current laws say that if you want to own one of these, you have to essentially let the ATF do a, you know, full, you know, they're going to crawl everywhere in your life before they're going to let you do it. And you also effectively allow them. I knew a guy once who had a collection of guns. They weren't full auto, but they were called auto shotguns, not automatic, but they were very, very short shotguns. They were often owned by folks who would be a bank manager, and they'd keep them in the top drawer of their desk against bank robbers, and they'd use them occasionally. They were called auto shotguns because back in the day when you had, you know, a Model A Ford and you were driving over the coast range down to the coast of the Pacific Northwest, oftentimes you'd be really slow when you got to the top of that hill, and sometimes people would literally come out and rob you. So they sold them as something you'd carry in the car, and it was shotgun. But it was very short. I think it was, 12, 13 inches long. Now, to own one of those, you have to have the ATF stamp, you know, pay the taxes, you know, let the ATF do all kinds of background on you. And the guy who owned this collection told me, he said, you know, if you have one of these, the ATF can walk in anytime they want and say to you, I mean, even if it's at your home, we want to examine the firearms. We want to examine all your paperwork. And he said, you better have everything in A-plus order or you're going to have a problem. People who are going to commit crimes don't like that kind of scrutiny, which is why I think that despite the fact that there are probably drug dealers out there with clean criminal records who could own these things, but they don't want the scrutiny. They've got the money and they don't want the scrutiny. There are wealthy people who could own these things and they don't, even in the states where they can. Because they don't want that kind of scrutiny for other reasons, you know, legitimate reasons. I like my privacy. I don't need the ATF, you know, crawling all over me anytime they want. It's enough that you have to go through the Form 4473 to buy a regular pistol or a shotgun or a rifle. Can you imagine the extra level of scrutiny that you'd have to take with that? Which is why I don't think it's ever been a problem. That added to the fact that I think the current market price of a pre-1986 full auto firearm in America is about $20,000. So
correct.
You got to have somebody who's got the kind of money that they don't mind dropping $20,000 on a single firearm and having the ATF all over their business.
Correct. And that's why I said, you know, we're talking about a specific above average type of citizen that's in America today. And I completely understand that. But my point is that we have these avenues in which if you wanted to, very similar to the man that we're dealing with after Sunday evening, that if you did have the means and if you did have the proper credentials, you could do it. My only point is that I'm all for gun advocation, but for sensible gun advocation, meaning that there should have been a very steep amount of training or class that this guy should have had to go through instead of just being able to, with his means and his background, to just go and buy 31 guns over 2 years.
Well, everybody focuses on the number. And for the life of me, David, this is the part that as somebody who owns guns, I'm not going to call myself the best expert on guns, but I know enough about it to think the number of guns doesn't matter. If he'd walked into that room with one single semi-automatic rifle, no bump fire stock, and a pile of ammunition, he would have been as deadly, could have been, I hate to say it, but it's true, could have been even more deadly if instead of just spraying bullets, he'd sat up in that room for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. I mean, the police didn't break in until after an hour and 12 minutes. But if he'd sat in that room and continued to shoot for the first 30 minutes, he could have killed a whole lot more people. I'm not doing that to encourage anybody. I'm saying understand the nature of the problem. The fact that he chose something that made him inaccurate at a distance or even up close was something that, you know, I'm not going to give him any props for saving lives, but the fact is he could have been more deadly. So when, and what happens is when reporters get the public to focus on he had 24 or 23 firearms, that doesn't matter. If they say, well, he had another 20 at home, that doesn't matter. One deadly shot with one rifle and one box of bullets could have been a whole lot more deadly than this guy was. Thank God he decided not to do that. And that's why I think the bump fire is kind of a gimme. Throw it away. It really did not make him more deadly. In some ways, it may have actually made him less deadly. And the fact that he could have acquired a full-on machine gun, you know, which, by the way, most of them are fairly inaccurate at any kind of distance. The SWAT team guys will tell you that. If they're going to shoot a bad guy, a sniper's going to shoot a bad guy, he uses a bolt-action rifle that fires one bullet at a time. You know, for the guys who are going in, you know, to raid a location, they will sometimes fire the Heckler and Koch, you know, MP5 or other similar firearms because they may need to lay down a lot of covering fire. But they understand that what they're doing is putting a whole lot of lead in the air all at once to get the bad guys to put their heads down. Right?
No, I don't disagree with that. I'm merely just stating the fact that we have these avenues for people with means to make unfortunately, a terrible decision like this man made. And I just think that if we want to start being reasonable about some of the certain things and the rights that we are able to have in this country that we live in, which, again, I wholeheartedly love, we should be reasonably thinking about different avenues, like a certain amount of training that it comes with to at least purchasing one weapon.
Well, except that, David, if somebody's going to go out and murder people, I don't want him to have one. If somebody wants to go out and buy 20 firearms, I don't care if they buy 20 firearms. And I've had people say, well, why would you want to do that? I will tell you, it's been a few years now, and I don't think it'll be this Christmas, but there was a Christmas where I bought, I don't know, 8 or 10 firearms for other members of the family. And by the way, I did it legally. I wasn't the one who technically purchased them by filling out the 4473. I paid for them and gave them as gifts to members of my family who then had to go down themselves and fill out the 4473 and go through the background check. So if somebody says, well, who would want to buy a dozen guns all at once? People who are buying Christmas presents in some cases. And for anybody who says that's not a good Christmas present, Jesus Christ himself believed in the right of self-defense, and I'm prepared to defend that position. So it's not a bad Christmas present. And believe me, you will never find anybody say, I have too many guns or too many knives. Equipment like that, you can never have too many.
No, and number one, put me on your Christmas list. Number two, I'm not debating that. I'm just merely saying that there are avenues that are in the current law system that you have stated. And again, I'm giving you the argument on the bump fire stock. I'm fully supporting you there. But all I'm merely saying is that if we want to start having a reasonable debate about things, when we say, well, what could we have done? What could we have done? This maybe is an avenue that we should all start thinking about, that if we do have the ability and the right to purchase and own weapons, which I'm all for, then you should have the ability and the rights to learn what that weapon is capable of and how to properly use it and how to properly defend yourself with it.
And store it. If we could get everybody in America to store their guns right, and it's both for your protection against criminals, it's for the protection of your kids and visitors to your home, for goodness sake, lock them up. If you can afford a $500 gun, you can afford a safe of some kind that will lock them up. And if people would lock up their guns, you wouldn't have a lot of kids, you know, getting hurt or killed in stupid, really stupid accidents. And I think I think a lot of prosecutors are averse to doing this. I would like to see people who improperly lock up their firearms and where it results in the death of a child. I'd like to see that person sit in jail for a while. Doesn't have to be their whole life. I mean, in some cases, 6 months might be enough. But I would love to, and I think in a lot of cases, they don't bring those criminal charges because they feel, in most cases, it's the person, the gun owner's own child who's died, and they say, well, he suffered enough. If you left your gun unlocked and your child either got hurt or died, you've suffered. But if you are the proximate cause of it by leaving it unsecured, I don't think you have suffered enough just from the loss of the child. I think you should sit in jail for a while. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I see a report this afternoon that says U.S. hotels, not just those in Vegas, are talking about adopting airport-style security. Can you imagine? Every time you check into a hotel, I have to travel. In fact, this month, I think I'm traveling probably 6 or 7 nights this month. Can you imagine every time you check into a hotel, they run your bags through airport-style security? That is going to be kind of tough. Let's go to John in Richland, listening on KONA, one of our great Radio Northwest affiliates. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Well, I've been listening, of course, through all the discourse with the bump stock and so on, and I'm fine with giving that up. The real elephant in the corner is, as a gun owner, I own several ARs. In fact, I compete with them. I compete in high-power rifle shooting and very, very good firearm for that. What concerns me as a gun owner and having another gun owner abuse such a firearm or any type of firearm for that matter mm-hmm. in such a manner is a big concern. I know in the past as gun owners, we've always, you know, we've fallen back on the fact is, hey, anybody that commits a crime with a gun, lock them up. I don't care what, you can execute them as far as I'm concerned. But now we have a trend of people that are, in a sense, have a death wish. Whether it be death by cop or they shoot themselves. And they take a lot of people, and of course, this gets a lot of attention. So what do we do in that case? It doesn't matter what the firearm is. It doesn't matter how many they have
no.
and so on. It's really who they are. Who are these people? These are people that own guns just like you and me, and they shouldn't be. It's kind of like the drug.
Well, except be careful. You're about to walk down a path that the Democrats want you to go down. Because
I know.
Well,
I know.
Only
just so
people understand what you're saying. When they say we should make it even tougher to buy a gun. So, in other words, a background check to see if you have a conviction as a felon, a domestic violence, or a history of being sent to, you know, mental hospitals, that disqualifies you. They want the disqualifier to be higher. Well, how do you go higher than that? I mean, there have been crazy people who've said, well, we should put everybody through a psychological assessment. What, once the first time you buy a gun or every year if you decide to own them? That's the only way to make it a higher standard than it is right now. And they say, well, we have to figure out who these people are before they do it. So you're going to predict future crime. Well, there's no way to do that effectively without taking the rights. I mean, in other words, I'm sure there are people out there. Jenny Burdick would probably take away all my guns if she could. She's the senator from Oregon who's the biggest gun grabber. She'd say, that Lars, he gets on the radio every day and says crazy stuff. Well, I don't think it's crazy. Most of my audience doesn't think it's crazy, but she thinks it's crazy. So who, you know, it's that old Latin phrase, who will guard the guardians? Ipsos, whatever it is. I can't say it anymore. But who's going to guard the guardians? Who's going to decide what the rules are? Well, the Democrats would say, we're going to decide what the rules are. We're going to make it so hard for anybody to own a gun that everyone will just choose not to own one, and they will have effectively taken away the Second Amendment. That's not acceptable.
No.
So,
no, I agree with that. I'm there. It's just a dilemma. It's a concern I have. I don't want these people in my, you might say, my club or my group. This is, I have fellow gun owners. We have a great time. We go out and shoot. We have a good time. We compete. We just have fun. And then here's these idiots or whatever you want to call them that ruin it. I mean, honestly, ruin it for everybody. I mean, I feel horrible. To the victims and so on and everybody in that. It's a terrible feeling. It's a helpless feeling.
But how do you identify and how do you stop a guy like this? I think the effective answer is you can't. And
yeah, I think
well, think about this. What have the jihadis started doing lately? They steal a truck and they drive it through a crowd of people. Now, if you have somebody who's really intent on committing mass murder, he's going to find a means to do it. It could be gasoline. It could be a vehicle. It could be a thousand things like that that are deadly to large numbers of people. And you say, well, let's take away all the things that you get. Well, what? Take away every vehicle? Take away every gas station? Make it a background check thing to buy a gallon of gas? Because that's what you're going to have to do if you're going to stop people with a murderous intent like Stephen Paddock. Because I don't think anything would have stopped Stephen Paddock. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.